I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about some of the things that Antonio was talking about with the rootworm damage on that. When I came into Minnesota about 2 years, or about actually 3 years ago, we started a project looking at some of the things I was interested in, starter fertilizer, looking at some of these nutrient mixes themselves and trying to get an idea if we can kind of tease out some of the responses, especially if we're dealing with the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium mix on high-testing soils. If we're seeing a response, what nutrient is actually responsible for that particular yield increase. So one of the things I've been seeing, especially when kind of doing a survey around the landscape, is just the prevalence we have of these starter fertilizer attachments. It kind of surprised me first going into Minnesota, especially in some of the areas where we have a lot of large farmers, how many of them still actually do use some starter attachments. We do see some pockets here and there of still some farmers using dry attachments, but the vast majority are using liquid attachments, placing it in furrow, and using a product such as ammonium polyphosphate. And a lot of the questions we get, especially in those areas, we still do have some broadcast fertilization going on, that even in some of those high pH soils where some of them think that we need to put a little small amount of starter on, trying to get an idea from them or from us in the research side what exactly they're getting out of those starter mixes. So we get a lot of questions on that. And my idea was to start to look at that in general and look at especially looking at some of the other data that would say in a high testing pea soil that if we're using a 1034-0 or ammonium polyphosphate that we're probably seeing that yield increase due to the nitrogen. So I just wanted to try to confirm some of that in there, then also go back to some of the research we were doing in Iowa before I left with potassium to see if there are any potential yield benefits out of these soils. So really the questions we're trying to address with this research, we had a grad student working on this, and I had a poster last year looking at the early season growth data on this. Mainly what we get a lot of interest is from the yield. So we're trying to look at these increase in starter fertilizer. What's the potential, especially in high testing soils? That's probably the biggest question I get with these mixes. And then looking at that, what nutrient may be responsible. Then looking at this project specifically, looking at hybrid differences. One of the impacts we were looking at, similar to what Antonio was just talking about, was looking at rootworm damage, looking at ice-line hybrids to see if there's any difference in potential response to starter fertilizer or nutrient response with a hybrid, especially in the presence of a rootworm pressure. So what we're looking at in this study was a small plot study. What we're looking at was a planter attached to apply a specific amount of nutrients. What we were looking at was 11 kilograms of nitrogen, 10 kilograms of phosphorus, and 19 kilograms of potassium per acre. Looking at that, applying in six different combinations, being a no-starter control, nitrogen only, nitrogen and phosphorus, potassium only, nitrogen and potassium, then nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And these rates we used were based around what we'd see a common practice for that ammonium polyphosphate for most of our growers. The soil tests we were targeting, again, for P and K were high testing, but we were getting some in that medium to lower testing. Right now, Minnesota, our cutup for a high rate would be about 15 to 20 milligrams per kilogram for that Bray test. Our high classification would be 121 to 160 for the ammonium acetate test. We still had a fair amount of a range in values. If we look at these numbers, we're anywhere ranged from about 15 milligrams per kilogram to 84 milligrams per kilogram of phosphorus, and 125 to 436 for the ammonium acetate. So some fairly large ranges in this. Now the two corn hybrids we used, eight locations over 2 years, we used the same hybrids at all those locations. It was always the nice line DeKalb 5044, which is a VT3 hybrid, versus a 5048, which was the counterpart without the corn rootworm trait. One of these then we planted with and without the rootworm protection, but again, looking at this, we did not put any seed-applied insecticide on these soils. So we're looking at solely what that damage potential is from that. We didn't look at what that potential for these hybrids, whether or not we protected them with a corn insecticide. Everything was planted at the same rate, about 86,000 seeds per hectare. And the analysis I'm going to show you, we did kind of a mix of a GLM and Glimix and SAS, looking at some fixed effects. And I really wanted to try to tease out some of the interactions to see if we actually had some interactive effects we could see in these studies. And really looking at it, averaged across most years, and this is looking at the actual analysis across that to look at those interactions. I wanted to look at to see whether or not we had any specific year interactions or site interactions to start to see if there are any difference in terms of the hybrid relative response or the starter response. Overall, looking at most of my interactive effects, we look at the year times starter, not significant. Location times the starter treatment, not significant. Starter times hybrid wasn't significant. And then our location and some of these others, we weren't seeing a lot of interactive effects. The only thing we were seeing, again, is looking at that site times hybrid. We're seeing some effect, some different effects across those sites with the hybrids. Overall, what we're looking at for a starter effect, and that's why I'm going to simplify things in this, is to look at across locations for a response to starter, because we did see a response to that starter mix even in these high testing soils. So I'm going to average that across there. I'm going to show a few different ways the way we looked at this, looking at both an LSD analysis, and then we also looked at some single degree of freedom contrast to try to tease out the specific recommendation or specific effects for nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So averaged across years, I'm going to look just at the 2008 and 2009 data. We do have four more locations from 2010. I didn't have time to get those worked into this presentation to look at the full data set from this, this study. Looking at our control, and again, I'm basically comparing this since we had a lot of comparisons with and without potassium. It's how we have the setup and what you're going to see in some of these tables. Looking at 2008 data, looking at our control versus most of our treatments, seeing a significant treatment effect for most of the treatments that we had potassium. And this surprised me slightly because we did have some broadcast K treatments out in different locations that I wasn't seeing consistent results. I look at 2008, it looks like we had a fairly consistent response to the potassium banded. And in 2009, we're seeing some of the similar effects. This wasn't a very large yield increase when we started looking at it, but it was still seemingly there, and I could pick it out from the sites when I started showing a lot of this data. You look at individually across these sites, you look at within these sites, we weren't picking up those significant yield effects in within those sites. It took me to actually be able to get enough data across locations where we had enough data points where we're starting to tease out some of these smaller effects from these individual nutrients. And across locations, if I look at both the year average, that actually shows that it looked like it didn't really matter with phosphorus or potassium. It looked like those were about the same. Looking at our LSD values, we're giving me an increase and maybe a small increase to nitrogen, but not as big of an increase as we did see to phosphorus and potassium. So it did look like there's something there in terms of that response. And when I looked at that specific response across those years, it was about 250 kilograms per hectare is what we were getting in terms of a response across these locations. So very small response. I think it has something to do when we start looking at it in terms of the placement rather than the fertilizer, because as what I said, looking at some of these, not picking up as widespread in some of our broadcast plots as we were in some of these. So it's been kind of surprising looking at this, and we're kind of looking at our recommendations a little bit more in Minnesota in terms of potassium and also with phosphorus, seeing some of these responses that we're seeing in some of these trials to see where we're at and maybe where we need to be in terms of our nutrient recommendations. But again, looking at this nitrogen phosphorus not giving us really anything in terms of a big response when I looked at it on a yearly basis. Now, as I said, one of the other factors we were looking at was rootworm damage on these plots. And I know I kind of went into this looking at, you know, I hope we get some rootworm damage in there to kind of look at some differences. And one site here, I got a little bit more than I bargained for here with about six rows flat in the ground. And so you got a lot of grumpy technicians or helpers there when you go to start harvesting some of these plots and you're picking them off the ground. But this is probably the most severe rootworm damage we had. Out of our locations, we average about two out of the four a year where we had enough damage really to get that, where I would consider a significant amount of root pruning. Anything above that 1.0 Iowa rating, we probably only had about two of those locations where we saw that damage. This is showing the actual field pictures from those plots there. This would be our non-protected or non-VT3. And actually, we did have two rows standing there propped up by the VT3 hybrid that were sitting right next to it. And these are some of the pictures we saw in terms of some of that root damage and that root pruning. So pretty severe root pruning from these plots. Now in Minnesota, we have do have a little bit different situation. We do see a prevalence of both northern and western rootworms. And it just kind of depends on where we're at in terms of the severity of there and the mix of those rootworms and presence of these fields. This field here, actually, we're looking at probably a little bit higher severity of northerns. But again, this is a field actually that it had been non-protected for a number of years, so we did look at having a very high severity in this field. Most of our normal fields looked like this, where we had a little bit of lodging, but not a lot in terms of damage from some of these fields. Looking at specific on the hybrid effects, I just summarized these across locations. As I said, looking at it was the only significant interaction we saw. Couldn't really tie this back to the rootworm damage, though. That was actually kind of the strange part. There were a few of these locations where we could see, especially when we compared the differences between our protected versus our unprotected, that there was a significant effect or a significant advantage of those hybrids. We had two locations. When we look at this, when I consider hybrid one would be with our corn rootworm protection, hybrid two is without. We had two locations where we actually saw less yield with that VT3. There's three locations where we had a higher yield, and then there's three locations where they were exactly the same. When we look at the difference in those locations, the ones where the VT3 yielded less, very high yielding sites, we're looking at about a 0.4 to 0.5 megagram difference between those locations. When we had the significant damage, we were seeing somewhere around a 1.1 megagram. So there's a difference there, but again, looking at it, no interaction with the starter effects. It was mainly a hybrid impact at these locations. And one of the sites I want to point out was that site actually I showed where it's flat on the ground. And this is actually one of the reasons why I'm glad I work with a fertilizer and not work with insects all the time, because it's not the most predictive in terms of response and not always the most predictive in terms of what we're going to see in terms of yield. And this is looking at with and without our corn rootworm protection, what those yields were and what those yield differences we saw with and without starter. And without starter, without our rootworm protection, we're looking at about an 8.8 megagrams at the site, looking at going up to about 10.1 without, and this was not significant by the statistical analysis. So this is one thing, looking at that, we can see some high numerical differences, but in the end, just with the variability we have out there, isn't the easiest in terms of being able to separate out some of those differences in terms of yield to see if there's actually something there with that interaction. We're also looking at plant data. This is the yield component's only one part of this. We have end of the season uptake, and we also have early season uptake to look at in terms of differences with some of these starter effects. So in terms of what we're seeing off of that, we do see a potential, especially in our northern climates, for a potential response to starter. Really right now, though, we're still kind of looking at some other data, some other projects to try to get an idea of where we're at in terms of being able to predict when those responses are likely. Right now, as I said, though, looking at that, what we've been seeing in this project, it seems like K's been one of the biggest impacts on our trial relative to the nitrogen and the phosphorus. So what we're seeing with and without the rootworm trait, we're really seeing a large potential difference, but again, we're not really seeing that interaction where I would have expected to maybe see something based on some of the data with what we've been seeing. It's just been too inconclusive at this point with the first 2 years to be able to make a kind of a decision on whether or not the starter is actually having a potential large impact with that rootworm pressure. So with that, it would be the end of what I have here. I want to thank you for your time. If there's any questions, I can take them on mine now, or actually if we're done with mine, we can actually go if there's any questions for any of the other presenters as well. So are there any questions on the stuff I presented? Well, this was actually a sideband we used in this one. Most of them we see are in furrow, but we're using that 20, that higher K rate. We applied it off to the side just because of potential risk for damage. So what we're seeing actually looking at that, you can see a little bit less. When you compare them side by side, we might see a little less growth early in the season on that, but in the end, it just doesn't seem to matter one way or the other. They seem to catch up once the roots tend to hit that band, especially those sidebanded treatments.
What about maturity?
We are in some other studies, and this one we haven't looked to see if it speeds it along. I've been using grain moisture slightly as an indicator of maturity. In this study, there just isn't as big of a difference. And looking at our sites from this year, too, I'm not expecting a big yield difference or maturity difference because of the earliness. We had everything planted by about the probably second to last week in April. So with the length of the growing season we had, I think the potential is not there in terms of seeing a big starter response this year from these trials specifically. We've got some other trials though I think we're going to see some responses on. John.
Quick question. Did you happen to notice whether the roots tended to prefer to grow near that band? So were you getting any differences between the hybrids?
And that's a question I do not know. We did some root digging early on to look at root mass, but we didn't look at the direction they were growing. So I can't really fully answer to see if they were any difference. I mean, granted, we used an isoline, and granted, they're probably when you ask a lot of the breeders, they would say, you know, they are an Iceland, but they do react almost as kind of a different hybrid themselves. So it's kind of hard to say whether or not that was happening or there's any difference in those. One thing we went with a starter on this to look at, though, with having the band close to maybe if we did have significant pruning, if we had a concentrated band close to that to see if there was effect. But again, looking at it, there just didn't seem to be much in the interaction side that would make me to say that there was a response with and without that rootworm pressure. Are there any additional questions for Mike, Rob, or Antonio?
Question for Mike. Mike, do you want to comment on the significance of the ortho to poly ratio in the ammonium polyphosphates and how long it takes to convert in the soil?
Yeah, it's generally from an agronomic standpoint not an issue, the conversion. Most of us recognize that plants take up P as ortho, and so poly, pyrophosphate and other polys have to hydrolyze to ortho to really have value. Generally, that process begins pretty quickly and is complete, dependent on, it's very temperature dependent, somewhat pH. Actually, my master's degree many years ago was on this, and texture factors into it and a lot of other things. But
it's really not
from an agronomic standpoint, yeah. It's not an issue. Sometimes, as a person that's worked with dealers and what have you through the years, sometimes there'll be a wave of rumors across the countryside that, well, that liquid material is not as good as granular because it has to be converted, but from an agronomic standpoint, it's not an issue.
Unless you're applying it as a foliar, right? Then that's a different story. You want ortho?
Yeah. And I may not be the best on that, but foliar, I would think that would be the case, yeah. Yes.
I have a question for the potassium. The last year we have seen a big increase in the prices of the potassium. This increase was similar to the nitrogen fertilizers. But in the nitrogen fertilizers, you need a lot of energy. So if the energy is very high price, it will increase. But I don't know if in the case of potassium, it's a similar need of energy, or it's just a trend when the nitrogen fertilizers increase the price, potassium increases the price.
I don't know that I can explain all the global fertilizer prices. They're pretty complicated. Obviously, there is a lot of energy used in potash production, the mining, the processing, the transportation, distribution. So energy is part of the cost, but it's certainly not as energy dependent as the nitrogen fertilizer is. So during 2008, when all the fertilizer prices went high, there were different reasons why some of them went up for different things. So I don't know if I can give you an answer why each one went up individually, but a lot of market factors that went up. Grain prices were up, so everyone was buying more fertilizer, and a lot of global things were happening. Food shortages, things in China and South America.